for our nation. We have a big treat for you in the next hour. We have our guests lined up, Stephen Kinzer, and I came across one of his books, and, you know, then I had to go on a search mission and find all the other ones I could get my hands on, because I found him to be a very comfortable author to read about very deep subjects in history with qualified expertise, and it just stopped me in my tracks. So, you know, and because of some of the problems we've had in the last little while, this was before everybody's locked down and stuff like that, but to get across town, taking public transit, getting to a bookstore that has the last copy of the brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and their Secret War, just was a trip to heaven, a pilgrimage, really, because then I could get into it, enjoy it, like I did his previous book. And the next one I got lined up, I read it already, and we'll have Stephen back to talk about that one, too. It just really opened my eyes, not that I was unfamiliar completely with the Dulles brothers, but to look at the fine detail that Stephen has brought up. You know, if we lived in those times, we would know nothing about how the world really works. We have the advantage of looking back with 2020 hindsight, where we can see things that may have been classified or not revealed publicly or something like that, to really add depth to the meaning of life. These were the foundation builders of an era. And he uses in the title, their secret world war, because in reality, they were fighting a war for big law firms, big companies, taking over other countries and small places and usurping power and authority over them. And to look at the technique, the style, and the fact that we can look at the consequences we live in now today is absolutely amazing. Welcome aboard, Stephen. Give our listeners a little bit of history about yourself in case they weren't familiar from the last time, where you've been and what you've done and how you got here.
Well, thanks for that introduction. It's wonderful to be with you. One of the responses I constantly get to my books is some variation of, I went to college, how come I didn't know any of this? Or, I read lots of books, I never read anything about this. So that's part of what I try to focus on. I'm trying to dredge up stories that were hugely important and shaped the whole world, but that for various reasons have slipped away from history. I'm trying to revive those. So how did I get to a position of wanting to do this? I spent more than 20 years as a reporter for the New York Times. I was stationed abroad. I covered overall probably more than 50 countries on about five continents, everywhere except Antarctica. So I saw the world from a different perspective from the people who write about foreign policy in Washington or in New York. It's very antiseptic there. It all seems very geopolitical and very clean. But when you're in places that are the victims of American foreign policy, you begin to see things differently. So I tried to reflect that in my reporting, but there's an inherent limitation in reporting because you're just reporting about the incident that just happened. That's what happened today. The next one is a story about what happened yesterday. After I finally left the New York Times, I began asking myself, so what did that all mean? So many historical events passed right in front of my eyes, and I had to jump on to the next one for the next day's story. But now I have time to think about how all those things fit together and why they happen. This is really the essence of what I'm trying to do. For a little while, I proposed to a couple of editors that I should write a memoir about my journalistic years, and they all told me this is a terrible idea because nobody buys journalist memoirs except for other journalists. So I finally was convinced not to do that. However, I have a title. For most of my books, I write the book, then I come up with the title. But for my memoir, I have a title for a book that's never going to be written. And the title comes from a wonderful old Cary Grant movie called Arsenic and Old Lace. And in that movie, Cary Grant plays a young guy who goes to visit his elderly aunts, and he discovers to his horror that they run a rooming house and they poison the guests. So he says at one point to one of his aunts, the aunt says, oh, the gentleman died because he had poison, drank wine that had poison in it. And Cary Grant is horrified and says, but how did the poison get in the wine? That's the question I'm asking in my work. The wine of world peace has definitely been poisoned. How did the poison get in the wine? That's what my books are trying to answer. And the Dulles Brothers book, most specifically, tries to trace back what America has done in the world, explain the reality of our actions, and then explain how those actions helped shape the world we live in today.
Well, I hope you do write that book, because I'd love to read it. And
well, at least you know the title.
At least I know the title. But, you know, the Dulles Brothers and you know, explain to, you know, maybe the uninitiated who have very little understanding. It doesn't seem like history to me so much, but you might not be aware of them, you know, where they came from, how did they get started, what roles they had in foreign policy and espionage, the family tree, so to speak. What got them started on the road to ruin, in a way?
Well, to answer that question fully, I'd have to read several chapters of my book to you, but let me give you a brief summary. So you're right, the Dulles Brothers have more or less faded from our collective memory. When I was writing my book, sometimes my friends would ask me, so what are you writing about? And I'd say, I'm writing a book about Dulles. And they'd say, the airport? As you know, a big airport in Washington is named Dulles Airport, and I used to think this was a terrible thing to have named an airport after that Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. But later I changed my mind, and I decided it was a good thing because if we hadn't had that airport, the name Dulles would have totally disappeared from our consciousness. So who were the Dulles Brothers? I believe they were probably the most powerful team of siblings ever to emerge in the United States, at least up until the Kennedys came after them, at least up until their time. So they grew up in a strongly religious environment. Their father was a Calvinist minister, very strict Protestant. They also grew up in an atmosphere of the American elite. Their grandfather was Secretary of State. They also had an uncle who became Secretary of State. So they were introduced at a very young age to the Washington elite. Then they both went to work for this extraordinary law firm in New York called Sullivan and Cromwell. This was not a law firm like normal law firms. It had a special practice. It represented essentially every large American multinational corporation. When a corporation needed something in another country or felt that it wasn't getting the concessions it wanted from another country, it went to Sullivan and Cromwell. And those lawyers would then go out and find ways to pressure and threaten and push foreign government to do what their clients wanted. So they spent many years shaping the world as active interveners in American foreign policy. This was a time when the line between, say, the State Department and private business and law was very weak. People went back and forth. And the Dulles Brothers were carrying out diplomatic missions for the United States and on the side promoting the interests of their own clients. Alan Dulles was the younger brother. John Foster Dulles was the older brother. When Eisenhower became president of the United States in 1953, he named John Foster Dulles as Secretary of State, and he named Foster's younger brother, Alan Dulles, to head the CIA. So this was the first and only time in American history that the overt and covert sides of American foreign policy were controlled by siblings, by brothers. Covert action during the 1950s was a world-shaping policy. Nobody understood it at the time, but Eisenhower was a deep, passionate believer in the use of covert action to promote American goals abroad. He had his own reasons, although he never spoke about them because he never admitted that he used covert action. But I think we can understand two things about Eisenhower. First of all, he had seen the value of covert operations during World War II. And secondly, perhaps more important, Eisenhower, of course, had been the commander of the Allied forces in Europe during the Second World War. In that capacity,
He had had to send kids out to die by the thousands. This weighed very heavily on him. And I think he saw covert action essentially as a peace project. It's a way to overthrow bad governments or change the course of nations without having to start a big war. So it seemed like a wonderful option. Now, I think if Eisenhower were alive today and we could say to him, look at the disasters that proceeded from your interventions abroad, from your covert operation, now are you sorry? And I think he would have said, you know, up until the time I was president, the United States had never carried out overthrows by covert means. And so we had no idea of what these overthrows and what these interventions could lead to in future decades. Now, of course, here we are in 2020, we can see that these operations caused not only huge damage to the target country, but also undermining American security. But we didn't know that back in the 50s. So I think he felt that history might stop. For example, we overthrew the government of Iran in 1953, and we put in a government that would do whatever we wanted. If only history had stopped then, that would have been a great outcome. But history doesn't stop. History keeps unfolding. And these interventions have terrible long-term consequences. And I'm trying to trace, in this Dulles Brothers book, particularly six cases where the Dulles Brothers and President Eisenhower focused on destroying a foreign government or a foreign leader, how they went about doing it, and what the long-term consequences have been.
Well, usually very, very poor. And, you know, like, you know, one that just breaks your heart, too, is the very beginnings of the Vietnam War are dealt with by John Foster Dulles, and how he was just totally intransigent to even consider or deal with other people. And basically just put the train on the tracks that, you know, you're going to run headlong into a war that will pretty much destroy a decade and more of American society and just tear its heart out. And
this was one
you know,
of
it's
the
just
great,
so sad.
This is one of the worst legacies, I think, of Secretary of State Dulles. So you take you back to 1954, the French, who were the colonial power in Vietnam, had been defeated by Ho Chi Minh's forces. And they had decided that with great reluctance and great pain, they had to abandon that war because it was unwinnable. Nobody was ever going to be able to defeat Ho Chi Minh. So after the French withdrew, a conference was held at Geneva in which the local authorities and the big powers in the world all came together to decide, with the French now gone, what happens in Vietnam. So John Foster Dulles, the American Secretary of State, represented the United States at that conference. Soon after he arrived, in the first few days of that conference, it became clear that the French, the British, and most of the other participants were all coming to an agreement on a single idea, which was that Vietnam should be divided for 2 years between a North and a South. After that, there would be an election in the entire country, and whoever won would become the president of the United Vietnam. Foster Dulles hated this idea because he realized that the most popular person in Vietnam was Ho Chi Minh, who was not only a nationalist, but a communist. So he determined, we're not going to go along with the Geneva Agreement. As he flew, he walked out of the conference. It's the only time in American history that a Secretary of State has left a major international conference in the middle. And as he flew home, he was developing this plan for how we are going to insist on defending South Vietnam, never have a national election, do whatever necessary to prevent Ho Chi Minh from coming to power. If that one guy, John Foster Dulles, had not made that one decision on that plane ride back to Washington, if he had decided, like the French did, we have to give away a piece of this country to the communists because there's no way to defeat them, and the communist leader is the most popular person in the country. If we had only accepted that and walked away, the entire Vietnam War that the United States fought would never have emerged. So you can actually point to this as one of the bloodiest calculations that John Foster Dulles ever made.
Oh, indeed. And as I understand from, I believe it was the 10,000-day war, originally Ho Chi Minh was fighting with American special forces and intelligence against the Japanese and was very friendly with a lot of these people and was hoping to model his country after the United States. So there was influence where we could influence. And all those bridges were burned, connections severed, which left him with no alternative but to deal with the next biggest rogue, various communist authorities.
You're quite right, and this is a really a poignant part of the Vietnam story. Ho Chi Minh had visited the United States as a young man. He was deeply impressed. He wrote about how fascinated he was with things like the bridges over the East River in New York and how wonderfully the Americans had come up with technical ideas to subdue nature and establish a powerful country. During the Second World War, Ho Chi Minh was leading a group of partisans in Vietnam that were fighting against the Japanese. So the United States decided we should find this guy, who we only knew as Mr. Who, and we sent a military team to parachute into Vietnam to find Ho Chi Minh and see what we could do to help him. The team did make contact with him, and we brought training manuals and various supplies for Ho Chi Minh's forces. He especially wanted American cigarettes, so we had large cases dropped down into Vietnam for him. Then, when World War II ended, Ho Chi Minh had a farewell dinner with the American officer who had been the head of this military team. And the American officer said to Ho Chi Minh, "Now that it's all over and I'm leaving, I have to ask you one question. Are you a communist?" And Ho Chi Minh replied, "Yes. But that doesn't mean we can't still be friends." Well, of course, from the American point of view, it did mean that. Once you said that, we didn't want to hear anything else. Ho Chi Minh wrote 5 letters to the American president and the American secretary of state asking for new relations. He wanted to send a group of Vietnamese students to come and study in the United States. He wanted to build agricultural relations between the two countries. But we could only see him as a communist. And for that reason, we posited him as an enemy and pushed him to away from America and led to this terrible war in which tens of thousands of Americans and well over 1 million Vietnamese were killed.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Like one of my favorite sayings from Winston Churchill was, it's always better to jaw-jaw than to war-war. And you can educate and get people into a better way of life if you have good relations with them. And I'm surprised, really.
The problem with that is that the American government in the 50s didn't believe that it was possible to negotiate with anybody on the other side of the ideological gap. For example, the Soviet Union would periodically come out with proposals for arms limitation or for reducing tensions between the two sides. It was always a principle of Eisenhower and Foster Dulles never to accept any proposal from the Soviets, regardless of its nature, because simply agreeing to negotiate with them would make it seem like they were legitimate, they were normal, they were a reasonable government. Foster Dulles was totally against any contact between American leaders like Eisenhower and Soviet leaders. He felt that it was important to convince Americans that we were facing a totally evil, nihilistic, and violently aggressive enemy. If Americans started seeing photographs in their newspaper of the American president chatting amiably with the Soviet leader, it would seem like the Soviet leader was just another normal human being, and maybe the Soviet Union just another country. Foster Dulles didn't want that. He thought that would break down the unity of American resistance to communism. So he fervently opposed any kind of what Winston Churchill called jaw-jaw.
Indeed. And that was the big story with Indonesia, too, is the leader came to the United States, was photographed, toured, et cetera, and then made a few faux pas that put him on the enemy's list rather quickly, and he had to be overthrown and destroyed at a great cost of life, too, as I recall.
The problem with Sukarno, the Indonesian leader, was that he came to the United States. He was beloved. He went to Disneyland. He addressed the joint session of Congress. He really captured the imagination of the American people, and he got great editorials. What a perfect friend of America. He represents all of our values, on and on and on. Then, after Sukarno got home to Indonesia, he decided, since I have now visited the United States, being a person who wants to have good relations with all countries, I'm now going to go visit China, which we then called Red China. This was seen with outrage in Washington. It was called the stab in the back by Sukarno. How could he do this? After coming to the United States and saying he wanted to be our friend, he now goes to China. His answer, of course, was, I want to be everybody's friend. One does not rule out the other. But for the United States, it did. And the fact that he would dare to go to China and meet with communist leaders put him on our enemies list. And as a result of that, Foster Dulles decided to try to foment a civil war in Indonesia. He had his brother Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, start that war. The Navy, the Marines were involved. We dropped huge amounts of material supplies to rebels fighting in Indonesia. And we really promoted a major civil war in that country with the hope of either overthrowing Sukarno or at least breaking up the country so that at least a piece of it could become a base for the United States. That failed, but it set in motion a series of events that in a few years led to an explosion of horrific violence in Indonesia, in which about 1 million people were killed, almost all civilians. So it's an example of how our blindness in the 1950s shaped an ideological divide that didn't have to be there.
Indeed, indeed. We'll see you on the other side of the break. I'm George Freund, Stephen Kinzer, Power Our Nation. Thanks for coming out.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Break the bond of Big Pharma. Hi, it's Joyce Riley with the Power Hour to tell you about the powerful benefits of Strauss Heart Drops. Many people today are locked into the routine of taking multiple prescription drugs. Strauss Herb Company believes that everything the body needs is provided by nature. Strauss Heart Drops may clear congested arteries, restore damaged muscle, maintain healthy cholesterol levels, and flush toxins and metals from the body. They may even be helpful in treating varicose veins. And unlike prescription drugs that are packed with chemicals, Strauss Heart Drops are 100% natural and harness the healing power of herbs like garlic, cayenne, white willow bark, and mistletoe. For the full line of Strauss products, I urge you to call the Power Hour at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or visit thepowermall.com. And remember, beware of knockoffs. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops.
You know what my mission was when I started this, when I was so excited? I still am excited after 21 years. I said anybody who's got mouth must use Vitamir toothpaste and mouthwash if they want to stay healthy. I'm going to make sure that it is available to anywhere I can put the product.
You got a lot of zinc in these products.
Zinc inhibits plaque growth. Zinc is also known to have an antibacterial properties. Also, zinc works to eliminate bad breath by destroying volatile sulfur compounds. Such an incredible product. And
wow.
I'm so proud to say my wife did that and saved my life, saved my mouth. And she is the mother of all the people who are using a Vitamer toothpaste and mouthwash in the world.
Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Buy from the good guys at theparamall.com. That's theparamall.com.
With dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Humana Food Storage is nutritious, is GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high-fructose corn syrup, has no chemicals, preservatives, or soy. And Humana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. Call Jay at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com.
America made just for you. Food stores I love to eat. Yum!
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Welcome back, Power Hour Nation. I'm your guest host from Canada, George Freund. Joining us today is, in my opinion, one of the greatest history authors I've ever come across, Stephen Kinzer, author of the book The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret War. And, you know, every book I've purchased with his name on it, I have to put in a special little section, but I also do some things for the station too, so I don't forget while I have it on my plate, because once I get talking, I won't stop, is the Power Hour promotions. Power Mall sales, go to www.thepowermall.com or call 877-817-9829, 877-817-9829, 15% off, up. Tavita products this week only, 10% off NAHS products this week. Flash sale, 15% off activated charcoal capsules while supplies last. And a flash sale of 15% off ancient minerals, magnesium products. And that's one of the big things that gets you sick is a lack of vitamins and minerals in your body that most of our foods are cleansed of before they even get to your plate. And that's a very, very important thing if you want to stay healthy. And we want you to stay healthy. We also want you to stay wise, because you can't really be part of this republic if you're in ignorance. If you just respond to whatever soundbite is on TV or the radio and are just lulled along in happy oblivion to go into oblivion, because then you walk into all these traps and pitfalls that are very well explained in history by Stephen Kinzer. And that's why, you know, you get your kids into reading this stuff. You know, you can pick up parallel documentaries and other things. You're going to find names in here that no one ever told you about. And when you get there, you're just going to love it, because I sure do. I've always been a fan of history, so I'm corrupted. But, you know, one little thing I learned here, too, is, you know, everybody always talks sometimes in mainstream media, you know, what are you trying to say? You know, that people meet in a little room somewhere and plan and scheme things. And the funny thing I found in his book was the little room in New York City on East 62nd Street where General Donovan would meet with other people to plan events and happenings around the world, because a lot of things happen in the shadows. And we don't find out about it until a long time later when history books are written.
one of the statements that really jumped off the page for me there was, we'll be in it before the end of 1941. And when we are, there are certain preparations that should already have been made, Donovan said. And I think we all know what happened at the end of 1941. And the plans are already being made. And we walk into another one and thousands of Americans go to their death and perish in Pearl Harbor. And then the big war starts and many others. And it's time that we can see how the I was teasing Stephen before we started about the connection with the phone and Maxwell Smart and the shoe phone he'd have. And sometimes when I have a bad connection, I say, you need to change the odor readers in your shoe phone. And his thing was, there was always this trick. This is the second time or third time we fell for this trick or that trick. And we don't need to fall for these tricks anymore. We need to know what they are and make them a staple food in our dialectic, so that when we deal with our leaders, we can ask them hard questions and put them on the spot so we'll never be fooled again. And only through a knowledge of history can we do that. And that's why this is so important. Where do people find your great proses in history, Stephen?
Well, I've written 10 books, and they're all available on Amazon and I hope at your local independent book dealer. I'm trying to focus, as I mentioned earlier, on the forgotten aspects of American and world history that have been pushed out of the books that we read. I think sometimes a historian can be kind of like a puppeteer. You can decide what's important and what's not. Sometimes I've read history books, and I feel like there's a tiny footnote that has five words in it that is actually more important than the entire chapter. For example, the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, in 1953, in the first CIA overthrow of a foreign government, was never reported. It kind of faded away. Now look at the situation that has developed in Iran over these decades and everything terrible that has happened there. It all stemmed from America's intervention in 1953 because Iran was then on its way to consolidating a solid democracy. So when I ask how did the poison get into the wine, I'm asking also about Iran, for example. Why did Iran go so badly? Why have they been so isolated? And why has the country followed the path it has? Trace it back to what happened when the United States interrupted Iran's progress toward democracy in 1953. So in my book, The Brothers, I list six of the leaders that the Dulles brothers made war on, and I explain the different cases, how they did it and what they did. But in a larger sense, I'm also trying to explain the mindset that led them to do this. And this is something very important because it applies today. Here was the mindset. In Washington, it was assumed, and this was something that was not just believed by the Dulles brothers, but transmitted to the entire American people, that the whole world was shaped by one big conflict, and that was the division of the world between what we call the free world and the communist world. One side is headed by Moscow, one side is headed by Washington, and everything that happens in the world is a subset of this great confrontation. But many people in Asia, in Africa, and in Latin America saw the world divided in a very different way. They saw on one side the United States, the Soviet Union, the British, the French, and all the big former imperial powers. On the other side were the emerging nations who, after World War II, were coming out of colonialism and were trying to find their way in a new world. So they saw a very different division of the world, and they saw the Soviet Union and the United States as more or less on the same side as exploiters, old imperial countries. We misjudged the tenor of the world. A number of leaders emerged during the 1950s, like Sukarno in Indonesia and Arbenz in Guatemala and Nasser in Egypt and Mossadegh in Iran and Lumumba in the Congo. These were all people who fit into what we called the category of neutralism. These were people who did not want to be pro-American or pro-Soviet. They had huge challenges in their own countries, which had been looted by imperial powers for centuries. They wanted to devote themselves to internal development, and they didn't want to get involved in the Cold War. The United States could not accept this. We felt that neutralism was in some ways even worse than communism because it pretended that it only wanted nationalism and development. We saw those neutralist leaders as pawns of the Kremlin, and that they had a hidden agenda, that at the correct moment, the Kremlin would call them and push a button, and they would then turn their countries into communist nations. So we fought neutralism, but neutralism was the dynamic spirit of the 1950s in most of the world, and that's what put the United States on the wrong side of history.
Oh, indeed, indeed. You know, I always love the movie Network, and, you know, I just look at all these powers as the vast dominion of dollars, and that, you know, how dare you interfere? Because, you know, the money is going to conquer and subvert nations and peoples into submission for the almighty dollar's mastery. And there's a short-term path, there's a long-term path. And generally, with greed, we grab the short-term path to say, this guy's in my way, the loot's behind him. If I push him out of the way, I can grab the bag of loot, and to hell with the consequences, because you can't even comprehend there's consequences. And then down the road, there's nothing but consequences, and the little bit of loot you acquired means nothing compared to all the damage you've done and all the money you had to spend for the consequences. Where if you just let it go naturally, you lose a little bit in the short run, but in the long term, you would probably gain plenty. And that's just the blindness of the human race, really.
I also think that it particularly applies to the Dulles brothers because of their work for over decades with America's biggest international corporation. So they moved kind of seamlessly from being lawyers who believed that American foreign policy must be designed to serve the interests of American corporations into positions of power, Secretary of State and head of the CIA, and they followed that same principle that any government that interfered with an American or Western corporation and tried to regulate it or limit it was an enemy of the United States. A great example of this came in Guatemala in 1954. Guatemala had emerged from dictatorship, and they had had an elected president. They were consolidating a democracy, and because it was a democracy, the government responded to the overwhelming injustice of Guatemalan life, which was that one giant American corporation, United Fruit, controlled almost the entire economy of Guatemala. It owned the only railroad network, it owned the only port, and it controlled huge amounts of agricultural land, including 500,000 acres that it never used. It just kept it there so that other competitors couldn't try to grow bananas, and poor peasants wouldn't have places to work, so they then wouldn't be available to come to work on the banana plantation. So because the Guatemalan democracy passed a land reform law, which required United Fruit to sell the land that it was not using, United Fruit went to the U.S. government, demanded intervention, and the U.S. government swung into action. In a major operation by the CIA in 1954, the Democratic government of Guatemala, headed by President Jacobo Arbenz, was overthrown. Ever since then, Guatemala has spiraled down into terror and violence. They had a civil war in Guatemala set off by this coup that lasted for 30 years and took the lives of 200,000 Guatemalans, almost all Indian civilians. And that civil war has been a direct result of American intervention in 1954. So a reckless decision in Washington sets off a series of unpredicted events. When you interfere violently in the internal affairs of another country, you're doing something equivalent to releasing a wheel from the top of a hill. You can let it go, but you have no idea how it's going to bounce or where it's going to end up. In the United States, we have this can-do mentality that tells us if there are any problems afterward, we'll fix them. it doesn't work out that neatly. The problems don't necessarily come home to us. But if you're a Guatemalan or an Iranian or an Indonesian or a citizen of any of these other countries where the United States has so violently intervened, you develop a natural suspicion of what the United States does and wants in the world.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Like that's, you know, for anyone who was of the Trekkie interest or something, but that was one of the big things the Federation used to say is to have the non-interference directive. And by and large, that would seem to be a much better approach than the calculated interference directives that we organize through our spy agencies and through big business. Because you can't see the damage, I guess, and maybe that's why, is, you know, if you had to live in it, and hear the screams, look at the bodies, see the blood, it would probably have a much greater meaning to you. But when you just go home to, you know, your well-intentioned suburbia and never have to see the consequences firsthand or wear them, then, you know, to you, it's just some kind of obscure concept that people have died or been impoverished or, you know, forever live in subjugation of one dictator or another dictator. It's hard to comprehend, but I do believe in the karma that it comes back to get you in other ways, and it's not a good thing to put out in the first place. And time again, it's just done and done and done. And if there's any, I don't even know how some of these nations even do business with us or talk to us after some of the horrors that have been unleashed on them. And, you know, good credit to them is, you know, they're very forgiving people. You can go to Vietnam as a veteran and not be hung in the nearest tree. You know, we seem to get along, and we probably always would have got along if we'd allowed that opportunity to grow. It just takes time. You plant a seed, you don't eat the fruit tomorrow. It's got to grow and nurture. And part of it is you have to help it grow and nurture, and then you get your result.
Well, what you talked about regarding how easy it is for Americans to ignore the results of our actions in the world really does harken back to my own experience. I've sometimes had people ask me, how come you're always the skunk at the garden party? Why are you always bringing up these things? Why do you see the world and America's role in the world so differently from the way most people in Washington see it? And I think it's precisely because I spent so many years as a reporter seeing what you just described. I saw enough blood and enough dead bodies and enough crying mothers to last me for several lifetimes. And since I've left that reporting business, I've tried to ask myself why that happened. Part of the reason is something that you referred to, and it's America's impatience. The idea that we could kind of sit back and wait and let things evolve and develop is very un-American. We want everything right away. And that is a very dangerous approach to the world. We also have the view that all of human history essentially has culminated in the brilliance of the United States and the idea of the United States. We have discovered the right way to run a country, the right kind of culture, the right kind of political system, the right kind of economic system. How churlish it would be for us, having discovered this wonderful formula, not to share it with the rest of the world. And the people we need to share it with most are the ones who are so backward that they don't even realize they need our help. The idea that we can coexist with many countries that have completely different cultures and different political systems and different economic systems without trying to change them is something very difficult for Americans to understand. We truly believe that our system is best for everybody. Other countries don't believe this. China has adopted a system that it believes is good for China, but would never consider recommending this to anyone else because other countries have their own histories and their own needs. The United States doesn't think like that. We think there's only one right way to organize a society, and we are going to insist that the world organize itself according to the principles that we devise. That's always a formula for conflict.
Oh, indeed, indeed. I know before we were getting involved in Afghanistan, I wrote our prime minister here in Canada at the time, Stephen Harper, just to say, you don't know your history, and even your recent history, but two British armies were conquered. in Afghanistan in the 19th century. And in the second invasion, they just let the doctor escape. The regimental doctor walked out of the mountains in the snow. It's a famous painting to find and look at. Yeah. To go back and tell them, don't come here. It's you know, the ground will eat you, and we don't even need the people to wage war with you too much. And then we make the same mistake again and again. And I said, even in the modern era, if you just look at the Russians failed, and they fought a war that's going to be 10 times more brutal than any war you think you're going to fight, and they couldn't do it. So, you know, why bother? I recommend it. If you want to do something, send peacekeepers to the Sudan and save people from starvation as opposed to subjugate Afghanistan. But the imperial idea was there. And I said, your generals are telling you that you win wars by bluff and bravado. And you don't. You lose wars with bluff and bravado because they have the will to win. When they have a family, you have so many sons that are to die in battle to fight the invader. And so many to, you know, look after the food and the family, so to speak. And you don't. The Western nations generally have one or two children, which may or may not be sons, and you don't raise them to die in some sort of battle to protect the homeland. So we're not prepared to pay that cost. So why would we want to get in a fight with them?
We've developed the fantasy that people all over the world are just waiting for us to come in and help them and show them how to do things. And that's what pulls us into situations like Afghanistan. We have developed this ideological overlay for the world in which we see this terrible enemy of terrorism. And we decide that because terrorism exists in the world, that justifies all sorts of American military operations, which in fact only produce more terrorism. But this is a mirror exactly of what was happening in the era of the Dulles brothers that I write about in my book, The Brothers. In the 1950s, we were also told the Americans are facing a horrific enemy that could destroy us at any moment. So although we are a peace-loving country and we always follow ethical and moral principles, there are certain moments when the situation is so dire that we must temporarily put those aside. But those moments keep coming up. It always seems to be a dire moment. Communism was the enemy then. Now we call it terrorism. Earlier we had other names for it. There's always been this idea that the force of barbarism is out there. And Americans think of themselves as the promoters of civilization, the enemies of barbarism. But when you sit in the countries where the United States has violently intervened, you sometimes feel that the horrors are not those that the United States feared, but the horrors are those that the United States creates.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Some of these excuses I just look at as they're just manufactured to get an impetus of public support for people to justify the war. So I use an analogy a lot of times with people to say, okay, you know, you look at something across the street, you want to take it, and you just go to people and say, let's go across the street and take this, and they're going to look at you like, what are you, an idiot? And then you say, wow, someone in that house across the street snuck over here and stole a child and took it back. We have to go rescue this child. And you probably orchestrated it yourself. Well, now people get angry, and you hear a scream or two, and you think, yes, it's true, he's right. And you're quite willing to run across the street and take this house, even though surreptitious means take you there. And we fall for these types of tricks all the time and are lured into these wars of conquest. And one of the best things, you know, maybe because I'm a child of the 60s, and I have a passion for the great reporters that were not just in Vietnam, but in many of the hot spots of the world, places you would never, ever want to be caught, unless you're with the United States Marine Corps beside you, because they are just completely insecure, unsafe, and dangerous. And that these people, for, you know, countless eons, have gone to places like that to report on things, and especially if you're saying something that's not too friendly about, you know, the government in power or the one and maybe the country you're residing, you're under a lot of pressure, to say the least. And these are unsung heroes, all of them, and that's why, you know, I hope, you know, we encourage you to do write that book on the reporter, because with your reputation, I think a lot of people would like to know what happened, what was it really like. And what did you see? Because you're the witness. You're the living history to this. I know a Vietnam vet, you know, he used to talk to me all the time about things going on in his life there. And I said, you've got to write a book. Like, part of it's funny, some of the things he did and whatever when he wasn't in combat zones or flying for Air America. I said, people got to know these things. This is great information. But, you know, maybe there's certain secrets he can't tell, I guess. But so I believe that history, all kinds of history has to be known, including the journalist's history, so that it's not left out in the cold, and to inspire a new generation to take up the sword that's attached to the typewriter or the keyboard to pen our way out of trouble instead of getting into it.
In my career, I've had a little bit of trouble. I've been shot at. I've been bombed from the air. I've been beaten by police. I've been imprisoned. I've been tear gassed. And here I am to live to tell the tale. So it is an enervating and very scary sometimes job to be out in the world and trying to find out what's really happening. But it's a shattering experience in a way, because you begin to realize how different the world is from the world that you perceived by reading the American press. The world is very different from the hyper fear mongering that we are accustomed to in the United States. We are promoting much of the instability in the world with our operations that we call stability operations. And actually, for long-term policy for the United States, a much better path to take would be to realize that we don't have the answers to every question, and violence is not the answer to countries' problems.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you, Stephen Kinzer. Thank you for what you've done as a reporter. Thank you for your books. Thank you for coming to our show. Bless you for all you've done. You're an American hero, in my opinion. I'm George Freund.
Bless
this is Power Hour Nation.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.